This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 18th, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at technicalities and glitches, because that seems to be what the week had. I want to start with a basic discussion, again, like we have the last couple of weeks, about what's been discussed online. This time, some back and forth on software glitches. Actually had some press coverage on this one that has come up in the past week. We'll then move on to a taxpayer who was attempting to argue that his lump sum Social Security benefits that covered multiple years should not have been fully counted in computing how much of the premium tax credit he had to send back to the government. We have a clarification from the IRS that safe harbor statements that are provided when you make the safe harbor election under the Section 199 Cap A rules for rentals under the Notice 2019-07 Safe Harbor do have to be physically signed and attached to the return as a PDF. We have a taxpayer's mistake in listing their old address on their tax return proved to be rather costly. And finally, the tax court said, sorry, it may be coming into Final Four time of the year, but the old basketball adage of no harm, no foul does not apply to late filed S returns. Well, this week, as we said, continuing on with our tax time, we're getting, again, everything hopefully is running well for you. Hopefully you finished all your extensions on the partnerships and S-Corps. And now we're into the one-month concentration on the 1040s that will get out before the extended due date, which probably will be significantly less this year, because we're going to talk about an issue here that's been bouncing around the tax discussion groups for a while and got some press coverage this week. We'll talk about are the software hiccups in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The changes, we were aware that we've had a major change in the tax law, and that has made a lot of changes in how the tax returns look. It's made changes in computations, and a lot of guidance came out very late. This was the perfect storm for our software to go a little bit strange on us this year, and it has. There was an interview earlier this week I had with Marielle Segura, that was going on a topic about why the IRS had received 2 million fewer tax returns. It was broadcast on a morning segment for Marketplace. Marketplace is a public radio program you may hear around the country. I was quoted briefly on basically a couple of issues. We had a discussion. Part of the discussion went on the fact that, that was not the part I was quoted on, but talked about the issue that a lot of people are just, after the initial reports of refunds, being down and people owing tax when they didn't expect to, that scared a lot of taxpayers. And so they're afraid to look at the numbers now. It doesn't matter the refunds have come back. All they remember is the beginning. They're scared things changed. And so we have 2 million fewer returns right now that have been filed with the IRS than last year. But as part of that, I mentioned that one of the problems we've got too, that's slowing things up, if you're a professional preparer, is that we've had not only learning about the new law, which has been significant, we're all hitting quirky problems and quirky issues that were, it's the first time you ever had to worry about this and this, because things like 199 Cap A or 163J, those things simply didn't exist previously. So you never, you're dealing with a lot of firsts this year. But also there have been a series of software glitches, problems, late implementations, other issues that have occurred this year that complicate matters. And this morning, recording this on Saturday, this morning I noticed that Tax Notes Today for Monday has an article written by Jonathan Curry, Business of Tax, Don't Trust the Software, that actually quotes a couple of people who are, tax Twitter people that are on there that, we discuss things on Twitter. It's kind of weird. There's a whole bunch of us that do tax discussions of various sorts. And again, the way Twitter works, it's highly informal as people follow each other. But basically, there are some on there that run these issues, which is interesting in the Twitter small space to make a comment. But Glenn Birnbaum and Damian Martin, both of whom are on the tax Twitter lines quite often, were both quoted in that article talking about some of the challenges with tax. Glenn with the glitch problem that we're talking about, where there have been issues and problems that have occurred in the software that just complicate things, including in updates that you get. And then Damian talked a little bit more about trying to develop procedures and software and planning and even, how do you handle things, how you make decisions and all those issues. They're general software related questions that came up. I just want to go over some of the issues that I've seen that have come up this year that involve us having to work with our software. And one thing we're hitting quite often, I think, is our software is making certain assumptions about Section 199 Cap A. And part of it is because the IRS was not terribly, well, first thing is, remember, we started in January without final regulations on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or they should say on Section 199 Cap A. Those final regulations came out mid-January. And so we've had the software company is now trying to scramble. We also got very late the worksheets that were going to be done for anything other than the very simplest 199 Cap A calculations. Those came out late as well. So the software company's been scrambling from day one. And they've been trying to just catch up with the things that are going to affect the largest number of people. And one place we have some real problems are in pass-throughs because they had to make certain assumptions starting the year. And for instance, you're going to find there's an inconsistency in a lot of software about whether or not if you have a partnership and the partnership claims Section 199 on an asset, that's a separately stated item. And depending upon your software, and some software now gives the option which way you want to do it, that may or may not be included in the qualified business income number that's passed out to the shareholder. And it's kind of interesting because apparently, at least as I read the final regulations, and everybody needs to check this because I can see how you might be able to read them the other way. But my take is that no, you know, you're going to have to check and see if you use the 199, if you use it to say the 179 on the individual return, you're able to use it, which probably in most cases, if it's passing out of here, you hopefully will be able to. Hopefully people aren't making 179 choices on a partnership, especially now with bonus depreciation being 100%. They're not deciding to go 179 without checking to make sure that the partners aren't going to have a problem with that because they have big losses elsewhere. But, you know, whatever we're doing, if you have that problem, you got to make that adjustment. Same thing about things like 1231 gains. 1231 gains, if they're taxed as capital gains, are not part of QBI, but if they're taxed as ordinary, they are, you know, and the same thing about 1231 losses. So there are adjustments that have to be made. Our software tends to just pick up whatever comes out of the K-1. We've noticed a lot of software, whatever comes out on the K-1 as the QBI number from the partnership is simply not adjusted. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a position of the software companies. That's just more the case of they've got a whole bunch of messes to deal with. They've got complexity everywhere. And it's just like you guys have to go deal with this. Another problem we're seeing there is what happens if your base is limited? Well, if your base is limited, then it would certainly appear for the final regulations that you would have to reduce that QBI number, that QBI loss, and it'd be pent up because we know we have to use it the next year. We actually use up the carryover passive loss. Well, of course, a lot of software is not taking care of that either. Right? You know, there's a lot of issues there. So watch very, very carefully on pass-throughs about what you're picking up as QBI, or if you're preparing a K-1, how your software is approaching the calculation of QBI, and probably consider disclosing how it did it. You know, so the partners have a way to understand what adjustments may need to be made. If you have separately stated items, it may very well need to be adjusted at the partner level. We also have discovered the software vendors, because the regulations came out late, you're going to find that sometimes it's just very difficult to do certain things. For instance, you may find that it's going to be difficult to treat all of your rentals as one enterprise without using an aggregation election, which technically is not correct, because if you're grouping them as an enterprise through the safe harbor, which then makes them a trader business, well, you can't aggregate until you have a trader business. So the bottom line is you shouldn't be aggregating, but some software offered that as almost the only option to combine all of those into a single QBI number. And it's going to attach, you know, it's going to want to attach that election and get somebody to sign it. Or maybe not. We'll get to that a little bit later. We also have calculation glitches here. That was brought up in the discussions. You know, Glenn mentioned a glitch that occurred to many of us using the software that he's using, where at one point on some S-Corp returns, just before the March 15th deadline, the software on a weekly update managed to double everything. Just kind of doubled the QBI numbers. Now, you could get it to fix it by deleting them all, putting a zero in, you know, forcing it to override with zero, recalc, go back in, then remove your overrides, and then it would work great. But there are glitches like that. The problem is our software is being updated rapidly, and those rapid updates can cause issues because obviously they can't do huge comprehensive testing every week when brand new updates come out. And so issues like that and glitches come in. So it's becoming an interesting day when you install the new update and you suddenly reload a return that you were just about to do the final release and, you know, send it out and upload it for electronic filing. You may discover that something changed on the return and it's not obvious. It may have changed because it should have changed, or it may have changed because it shouldn't have changed, but that's a software glitch that we've got. It's a problem that we're there. So we have all of these issues. We also this week had a discussion online. We have hot asset gains from publicly traded partnership sales. Most software has trouble dealing with that. In fact, I think we discussed a couple of different software versions, ProSystem FX. I think we were talking about UltraTax in a discussion. And we're discovering that in essence, it appears there's no good way to get that into the right category of being a publicly traded partnership item. Because remember, that's a separate bin of qualified business income from the regular, without actually just kind of going in and having to manually change the number and override things. So it creates issues with us. That's an area that we've got problems with. We also have problems with we're going to talk about here shortly about the need to attach a PDF signed election for a safe harbor election. And, you know, some people got confused about how you do that. For instance, software, you know, you may be looking for some specific, you know, type of thing you're attaching, and there will not be any such list of attachments. There should be some other way to attach other generic attachments in your software, but now you've got to go find that, and many people may have never used that option in their software, maybe having fun finding it. And making it even more interesting now, some of our software is, of course, now getting ready to add this in, so we may very well see this have a dedicated place on the software after you've already set up for a non-dedicated place. So this is all getting interesting. And again, there are issues everywhere. We're seeing unique issues with 163J calculations, and maybe more specifically, what is or is not being passed out on a K-1. Information about, you know, is it computing and somehow passing out, which most are not. Information about a partner's share of gross income and their share of the interest if we have a small business partnership, because those under the proposed regs have to pass that out. So there's a lot of complications this week on software. Just be aware of that. Okay. And obviously, the final thing is, I will mention, for instance, CCH ProSystem FX will allow me to enter all kinds of information about things that are part of the extender package. And it'll even try to put them on the return. But you can't file it that way. So we have issues like that where they have things stuck in there. Just kind of interesting week. Okay, let's go ahead then and on to actual developments this week now. Let's go to the case of Johnson versus Commissioner, 152 TC number 6. This was on March 11th of 2019. In this case, the taxpayer received a Social Security payment that was a lump sum payment. That happens often if somebody's applying for Social Security disability. There's a period where they're evaluating whether or not they should qualify for disability. That may take an extended period of time. There may be appeals, et cetera. But if they're finally awarded it, they go ahead and they pay up the Social Security from the date the person should have been eligible to start receiving the payment. As I recall that rule, it is 6 months after they were disabled. So in this particular year, the taxpayer got what was effectively Social Security from two separate years. Now, that's a problem because they had gone to the exchange that year and they had gotten insurance and qualified for the advanced premium tax credit. As we are aware, you go there at the exchange, the exchange asks you, what do you think your income will be this year? You tell them, based on that, they compute what credit you probably would qualify for, and then they reduce your monthly premium by that amount. Of course, the problem is at the end of the year, you have to calculate what your real credit should have been. And if it turns out that you didn't qualify for as much credit as you initially thought you would, because it turns out your income was higher than you'd originally estimated, you have to pay that back. This particular taxpayer was in that position. He did that. He went back. He got the Social Security award. Social Security is added to modified AGI, not only the amount that is, you know, not only the amount that is included in your AGI for the year, but also the amount that is considered to be, you know, that is excluded is also to be added in per the language on Section 36B. Well, in this case, what's happening in this case was there's a special rule at Internal Revenue Code Section 86C, and it allows you to basically reduce the amount you include in income if you get a lump sum. If you make that limitation, that you basically, for those that are in any lump sum payment that is attributable to a prior taxable year, and they make an election, the amount including gross income for the taxable year by the receipt of that portion shall not exceed the sum of increases gross income under this chapter for prior years, which would result from including. Long way of saying, you go back and figure out how much of this would have been in their income for last year. And the reason why you do that, because in this case, it was 2 years, it was just one prior year. Because remember, the way Social Security works, we start out with nothing included, we start getting 50%, then we get 85%. So the theory is this lump sum payment could kick somebody in the 85% level where they never would have gotten outside of the 50%, or maybe into the 50% levels when they never would have had anything taxable except for this doubling up that occurred. So the taxpayer made that election. Now, having made that election, though, he still ended up with a problem that the IRS said, you know, you still got to take that whole lump sum and add that in computing your modified AGI for how much of the premium tax credit you got to pay back. The taxpayers say, well, wait, that's not fair. 86E was supposed to put me in the position, you know, as if I'd done the prior years, not pick up any more in income. And it's like, so that really shouldn't count. 86E election should take this out. It relates to prior years. It's not this year's. It shouldn't count in computing my penalty. Well, maybe that makes sense from a fairness standpoint, but as the tax court said, it doesn't. It's not what the law says. The law says you have to add back things excluded from gross income by Section 86. This election under 86E still excludes it from gross income. So it's still an amount of your Social Security that's excluded from gross income. This is merely a computational issue, but it does not change the fact that you're going to have a portion excluded that has to be added back. And that add back has to count in computing how much you have to pay back. Next up, there was an article that was written by Eric Yauch. It is IRS open to additional guidance on portion of Section 199 Cap A. Was in Tax Notes today on March the 11th. Now, what happens here is we have notice 2019-07 told us, remember, if you qualify for the rental safe harbor, it tells us there's a statement where to attach, and this statement is to be signed by the taxpayer, a person knowledgeable, that they meet all these requirements, has to sign this statement under penalties of perjury. The question that was asked in this particular article, you know, it was asked at a conference of, in this case, Robert Alinsky of the Office of Chief Counsel of the IRS, was how do we handle this for electronic filing? In essence, can I just attach a printed statement, you know, do a note, like do in my software, do as a footnote, and you would just attach that to the return, and then does the signature, the main signature, which as we know is quite often just that, you know, the code you type in, is that going to qualify as signing that form? And in this case, Mr. Alinsky says, no, you have to have a signed version of the statement. It has to be signed by the taxpayer or whoever the representative is that's going to be signing it. And it has to be then attached to the return. If it's electronically filed, that means you scan it and then you attach it to the return as a statement. Now, again, your software probably doesn't have a place to put this yet, but you probably have a place where you can do an other PDF attachment to a federal return. That's where this is going to have to go. That makes it a bit troublesome because now not only do I have to get the signed document back, you know, the electronic filing authorization, I need this form back too, because I have to be able to scan this and send this on. So this is another piece of paper that if you're going to make the safe harbor election, you've got to get this thing signed and attached to the return. Now let's go to our technicalities of the week. Technicality number one, the case of Gregory versus Commissioner. Taxpayer. Here's what happened. Taxpayer went to file his tax return for a year. Okay. He filed for an extension of time to file the return. That, of course, gave him till October 15th to file the return. Now, this couple, and I should say it was a couple, actually married couple. So this couple, they filed for an extension. In June, they move. So they relocate, in this case, moving from one city in New Jersey to another. And then in October, they finally file their return. And we're not told how, but I wouldn't be surprised it was filed electronically. And of course, what somebody does in that case was they just file what they had that entered in April as their estimates. They got everything cleaned up and you hit the send button. Well, never having a paper copy, they failed to notice that they'd never changed the address on the return. So the old address was on the return when it was filed. Okay, that's kind of a problem because what happened was, of course, that the IRS is generally under no, it's basically sends any notices to the last known address. But between the filing and when the IRS sent the notice of deficiency, the taxpayer sent in a power of attorney form. The power of attorney form that appointed somebody power of attorney had their new address on it. So it had the address, in this case, it moved to Rutherford, New Jersey. So it had the address in Rutherford on it. In addition, again, the next year, they're doing their 1040. This time they got the right address on it, but they are not ready to file. So they sent in a request for extension of time to file, Form 4868. That also had their proper address on it. Now, 2 days before October 15th, which is the date on which they would file the return for the following year, the IRS sent them a notice of deficiency related to the prior return. My guess is it's a CP-2000. It was an information matching issue. The original notice almost certainly went to the address in the wrong location, in this case in Jersey City. They obviously didn't pay attention to that. So the IRS then, you know, sent out the letters and sent out the notice of deficiency. And so October 13th, they do that. October 15th, the taxpayer files their 1040 for the following year. But the problem is they don't even become aware until more than 90 days. In essence, the letter was issued October 13th of 2016. They didn't become aware that there had been a deficiency, basically an assessment issued, a notice of deficiency. They weren't even aware that that thing had been mailed, had been sent out, or was involved until January 17th, which is a few days after the 90-day period ended. So now's the hitch. They try to file in tax court because obviously they've blown all their other options. So they want to go to tax court, not pay this because they're disputing it. We all know CP-2000 notices are often in error. Let's take as an assumption that this CP-2000 notice is in error because I think there's a reasonable chance it is. So the problem was, of course, the IRS sent the address on the Form 1040. Now they said, wait a minute, IRS, we notified you. We notified you of our new address. So you're our last known address. You got two separate pieces of paper. And you had the months before you sent out this notice of deficiency. You had that for 2 months before. We should not be bound by this. You should have sent it to the wrong one. So technically the notice hadn't been issued. So technically we still have our 90-day period to file in the tax court and it should all work. The IRS said, no, guys, sorry. We sent it to the last known address and, you know, tough luck. You didn't have it. Well, the tax court took a look at this case. It's kind of interesting. The IRS does have regulations under 301-6212-2. And what that says is basically it's the most recently filed and processed return is generally what counts for their last known address. Well, in this case, that obviously was the one with the wrong address on it. So that's bad. However, if the IRS is given clear and concise notification of a different address, then that will basically take over for the address on the return. As we all know, we have the official IRS change of address form that can be used for that. And generally, you should be using it for that. But here's the question. Does the Form 2848 or the Form 4868 qualify either as a tax return? Because both of these have been processed by the service. Or does it qualify as clear and concise notification? Well, the IRS issued Revenue Procedure 2010-16, which is the most current version of what constitutes a tax return. And neither the Form 2848 nor the Form 4868 is listed as a tax return in that list. In fact, it's specifically called out in Section 5.01 (4) of the Revenue Procedure that the term return does not include applications for extension of time to file a return or powers of attorney, the two very things they sent in. So those aren't tax returns. Well, but didn't we actually give them clear and concise notice of a new address? Well, the first thing is they tell you, continuing on in that sentence, that they will not use either of those firms, will not be used by the service to update the taxpayer's address of record. And more to the point, the instructions for both Form 2848 and Form 4868 specifically say that if you change your address, this form will not update it. You should send Form 8822, the change of address form, in if you need to update your address, because this won't do it. The tax court had previously ruled years ago that in the case of Hunter versus Commissioner in a tax court memo case 2004-81, that a Form 2848 had served to put them on notice that there was a change of address. But the court noted that at that point in time, there wasn't this REBPROC that said it didn't count. And secondly, probably more importantly, at that point in time, the instructions didn't say it didn't count. The court said, based on that lack of notice to the taxpayer in the instructions, that a taxpayer reasonably could assume that this was going to be an update, you know, that this would update their address. The IRS has changed that. The court said they specifically looked at the case law where they had lost on this issue, and they changed their instructions and their notices to go with that. And the court said, you know, taxpayers are put on notice this doesn't work. As such, it's disallowed. Now, remember, these taxpayers are not totally without ways to solve their problem, although technically it gets messy from here on out. I mean, the official way to move forward at this point would be to pay the tax and sue in district court. Two problems with that. First, you got to come up with the money to pay what may be an absurd tax amount, especially if this involved a failure to report items on a Form 1099-B. We know the IRS in that case assumes short-term holding periods and no basis, so we can have insanely high numbers there of tax due. So paying the tax and suing for the refund may be very difficult. Secondly, district court is very expensive to litigate in. Tax court is not cheap, but it's much less expensive than district court generally. So that's fine. The other ways they could go for it, obviously, you can try for audit reconsideration. That, of course, is totally at the discretion of the service. You could go for a collection due process hearing and try to get around it. That's other ways. But obviously, they're not optimal ways to solve the problem. But they are available to the taxpayer. So the problem is, as the tax court would say, this is a matter of jurisdiction. And in a matter of jurisdiction, the tax court has to follow the intent, the language of Congress. So the tax court's not allowed to hear this case. This case would be appealed to the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit had a case even earlier than Hunter that allowed such a notice to be a change, to be notified of a change of address. The Hunter case essentially, that Third Circuit case again predates this. So it's possible that Gregory may be able to convince the Third Circuit that, you know, really that this notice wasn't adequate with your concerns you had back when. But I have a feeling it may be a problem. In any event, even if they can win this, let's be honest, for our clients, we don't want to have our clients be in this position. So yeah, please warn your clients, file the change of address form, the 8822. That's the safest way to make sure you don't get caught out in this problem. And secondly, yeah, double check on your extension returns, especially these days with electronic filing and with refunds being deposited in the bank account or being drawn directly from the taxpayer's checking account. You know, the address on the 1040 may not seem like it's a big deal. Nobody really pays much attention to it because it's not going to cause any problem until something like this happens. So just be careful. That's one of those things that's really easy on the October extension date to miss that, yeah, we didn't update that address. Finally, this week, let's talk about it's basketball time, right? The Final Four. We're going to get in the NCAA tournament here. Well, let's talk about the concept of no harm, no foul. This is ATL and Sons Holding Inc. versus Commissioner 152 TC number 8, issued on March 13th of 2019. The taxpayer in this question failed to file for an extension to file time to file the S Corporation return, something a lot of you were filing just last Friday, right? You're all filing your extensions. Well, this taxpayer didn't file that. They did, however, for the year in question, file a Form 4868 for their individual return. They owned 100% of the stock of the S Corp. The S corporation did file the S corp return before the September 15th due date that it would have been required to file, and they timely filed, before the extension expired, their individual return. Nevertheless, the IRS assessed the penalty against them and said, "Hey guys, we should have a penalty." The taxpayers argued, "Well, wait. This is a no harm, no foul situation, right? In essence, every dollar of income was reported to the IRS. They received their tax exactly when they should have, or if there was any underpayment, we paid the interest, right? Everything was done the way it was. The IRS was not put in any worse shape than they would have been had we filed the return. And for that reason, we should be able to escape this penalty." Well, the tax court didn't buy that. The tax court said, no, the penalty was not on whether the IRS got their money timely. The penalty is imposed on whether the information return was filed timely with the service. And regardless of whether the service is harmed, they said, and there are other reasons why you might consider the service harmed, but let's ignore that. Even if the service is not harmed, you still have an obligation to file that return timely. You failed to do so. Because you failed to do so, you owe the penalty. Now, interestingly enough, it turns out in this case, they did it a second time the next year. That year, the IRS waived the penalty. It's kind of interesting as to why the IRS waived it that year and not this year. But the court said it's irrelevant that they waived it the next year. Each year stands on its own. And the court did not said this is not reasonable cause for not filing an S election. That's not reasonable cause to say there's no harm to the service. Now, one other issue that came up, we discussed this a couple of weeks ago, right, in a case where they had done this. We did get back the issue of the supervisory approval. In this case, the IRS, much like in the Walquist case we discussed earlier, found that this was going to be an automatically calculated penalty in this situation. Because again, there was no supervisory approval of this. It's just simply, dollars per month. The taxpayers tried to argue, wait, there's this reasonable cause clause in here, so it can't be automatically calculated. The tax court said, nope, you're missing the point here. The reasonable cause has to be asserted by the taxpayer. So if you don't contact the IRS, it can be automatically calculated. Apparently, they never actually asked the IRS to waive this penalty. And I say that because this actually came out as a collection due process case. So it seems very likely they kind of ignored the notices. And eventually, it just became bad news. And now they're stuck and they have to go through collections to try to avoid paying it. And they asked them to waive it in collections. Collections said no. So now they're going to the tax court. So yeah, we're late in the game in this case. Seems like it was mishandled, shall we say, to put it mildly. But in any event, the court said, nope, it's not. It is automatically calculated, therefore. And just like they did in Walquist, they decided that, in this case, where if there's no taxpayer response, effectively, it's an automatically calculated penalty because the only thing you have to do is multiply the penalty amount times number of months until it got filed timely, and then you're done. Well, hopefully your tax season is going well. And hopefully you're able to use whatever you learned in your courses this year. We are working on the courses for the coming year, trying to find out what we're going to be doing, working on various things to get up and running. I will be speaking at an industry conference in Atlanta for the Georgia Society right after April the 15th this year. It's the following week. So we'll be talking about tax updates there. We're going to be starting with courses in May on a more standard structure, be doing those sorts of things. We'll be working on the course. Like I said, I'm working on that marijuana course, which is interesting. So that's going to be an interesting run. We'll have those things up and running this year, doing courses there. So in any event, take a look. When you finish tax season, be sure to take a look at your state society offerings. Hopefully, we'll come out and see us in one of those courses, either the accounting and auditing courses that Kaplan Financial Education is offering this year, or the ones in tax. I'll be doing mainly the tax courses this year. I think I have a couple of ANA courses I'll be teaching in various locations, but mainly tax. Come out, see us this year when those catalogs come out, and we look forward to seeing you there. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 18th, 2019, make the right year. You can catch our updates every week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com online as we post them, the written versions. If you have any questions or comments, send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle is at Ed Zollars, and yes, you can follow the tax Twitter crowd there. You start following the right people and you'll find all these things. Lots of news breaks there. It's kind of an interesting place to go. If you want to really know what's happening in taxes, it's kind of an interesting place to follow. I also follow discussions that I mentioned every week on Reddit at r/taxpros. Also deal with the Tax Talk site with the California Society of CPAs. So I'm on there, and that is open to any CPA anywhere in the country that wants to sign up there. And you just have to get yourself into Yahoo groups and get going. I'm also part of the Connect site on three societies I'm a member of, the Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota societies. So I tend to look in there and see if there are questions going on. So you can catch me there if you're a member of one of those societies. Otherwise, we look forward to seeing you next week. We'll talk about whatever's been happening here in the area of taxes. I'm sure more will happen. And hopefully we'll keep our heads above water for the next week. You'll survive, and we'll see you back here next week on Current Federal Tax Developments.